this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline for the cover story, Regulate This. Local and state lawmakers wrestle with rulemaking for shared service technologies such as Uber and Airbnb. And that headline's on the cover. The actual story is inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline. A new roadmap. Shared service technologies necessitate new rules. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. They're here, digital hitchhikers, and they're growing faster than the state can regulate. Armed with Uber and Airbnb-enabled smartphones, they can solicit a ride from a private vehicle or a room from one of your neighbors, all with the touch of a button. They're the growing customer base of the shared economy, services like Uber and Airbnb that don't pay taxi fees or hotel occupancy taxes. But they do add to Raleigh's innovation brand. Some say that's enough, that embracing technologies lauded in other entrepreneurially focused communities shows that we too are innovators. But others say it's out of control, that safety issues, if left unaddressed, could have dire consequences in Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, and all our neighboring cities. In the coming weeks, a group of 170 legislators in Raleigh, many of whom have never turned on an Uber app, will be deciding whether North Carolina should arm itself or embrace the change. New line of business. For the past 4 months, Ali Kasey, he wouldn't provide his last name, has been navigating the streets of downtown Raleigh. Ali Kasey, who won the green card lottery 3 years ago, used to be a mechanical engineer in Belarus. But I was earning less money than here as a driver, he says, a wry smile forming in the rearview mirror. Ali Kasey is one of the undisclosed numbers of drivers for Uber, using his private vehicle and contracting with the Silicon Valley-developed app to connect to paying riders. By 11:30 a.m., he's had about 3 fares. Some days are busier than others, he says, but it's a living and a good one. He'll meander this route until around 8 p.m., about 12 hours a day, to make it worth his time, perhaps stopping in a parking lot to read between fares. Greg Stebbin, a journalist who works out of his Five Points home in Raleigh, is renting out his just-renovated spare room on short-term rental site Airbnb. He's among the 407 Raleigh listings on the site, but one of only 2 homeowners who have been issued zoning violation warnings by the city. As of mid-January, he hosted more than 20 guests in about a 3-month time frame. But an anonymous complaint to the city could derail his new business. I really enjoy it, he says, motioning to brightly colored sheets he personally changes after each guest leaves, and the pro-Raleigh posters framed on the walls. I feel like an innkeeper. I really am an innkeeper. He says he doesn't have a Pollyannish attitude about Airbnb. Regulations, he says, can coexist with the business. The city just needs to hunker down and work with shared services companies. But it's a bigger issue than cash in contractors' pockets. Tax dilution. For regulators, the primary issues in the shared economy will be to address the potential loss of service taxes and safety concerns. Currently, rideshare services don't contribute fees to municipalities. Taxis, on the other hand, do. Revenue from taxi fees, fees that Uber and Lyft don't pay since they are not regulated by the city, put $93,535 in Raleigh's municipal coffers in 2014, cash that was used for general fund purposes such as police and emergency communications. And that number gets substantially bigger for companies in the room rental business. More than $18.5 million was collected in Wake County room occupancy tax in fiscal 2013 to 2014, tax that, while hotels have to pay it, Airbnb does not collect. From last July through December of 2014, that total was $10.7 million. Much of that revenue goes into promoting arts, culture, and events across the county. An entity that's not budging, however, is Raleigh-Durham International Airport, which continues to cite rideshare drivers picking up fares on its campus without permits. The airport tracks permitted drivers' trips to RDU, charging a fee each time. In 2014, 316,357 were tracked. Stebbin, the Airbnb vendor, agrees that taxes should be paid. We're not trying to get away with anything here, he says, adding that he already reports his Airbnb revenues to the IRS, and if there were a mechanism in place to pay the room occupancy tax, he'd pay it. Regulations are fine. Raleigh needs to be a leader in this. Mitigating safety concerns. As the idea of peer-to-peer services continues to blossom across the country, the cities who figure out how to thrive in the shared economy could come out winners. Raleigh and burgeoning entrepreneurship cities like it are competing for startups with the likes of Austin and Kansas City, and proponents of ride and room share services say a stance against the shared economy could be a black spot on the City of Oaks' reputation as an innovator. But those tasked with possibly revamping North Carolina's decades-old ordinances to accommodate the services say there's a concern that Trump's branding, safety, all it takes is one tragedy. Shared economy services say they address the issue. Uber spokesperson Taylor Bennett says the company has an extensive background check policy, along with insuring drivers, with policies issued by Raleigh-based James River Insurance Group. The company institutes a check that goes back 7 years. But the city of Raleigh has a longer list when it comes to background checks. Taxi drivers are submitted to fingerprint checks, drug tests, and a State Bureau of Investigation's background check in addition to a written test, says Jay Arnold, sergeant with the Raleigh Police Department. Bennett says that doesn't mean it's any more in-depth. Fingerprinting really isn't as inconclusive or extensive as the background checks we have in place, he says, adding that drug testing is not really effective. What we've seen is it doesn't prevent people from using or doing drugs. Uber has real-time feedback, Bennett points out, adding that it's a much more instantaneous way of responding to troubled drivers. After every single trip, the rider and driver rate each other, he says. If a driver is reckless or unsafe, we can take immediate action. But some taxi companies are instituting similar policies. Michael Solomon, CEO of Taxi Taxi, says its app, too, provides for immediate feedback. If we have a driver complaint that we can verify to be true, the driver no longer drives within our system, he says, adding that video cameras are installed in its cars specifically for safety and litigation reasons. That's something Uber can't really talk about, he says. With Airbnb, verification happens through social media sites. The service connects an Airbnb profile with other sources of information, such as LinkedIn. Users are asked to take a photo or upload an image of their government-issued IDs. Airbnb does not perform background checks, but does have an identification verification system that incorporates social media profiles. More could be done, says Stebbin. It's all new. Legislation, both on a state and municipal level, has yet to catch up on the new technologies, but educating the lawmakers comes first. This year, both state legislators and Raleigh Council members have plans to address the idea of shared services. Representative Julia Howard, a Republican from Davie, like many of her peers, is from a district without Uber access. It's all new, she says, and we want to do it right before we do anything. Representative Jonathan Jordan, a Republican from Watauga, first heard about services like Uber and Lyft 5 months ago. He, like Howard, comes from a district that rideshare has yet to touch, and much of his knowledge has come from general news stories. He has more questions than concrete opinions when it comes to shared services such as Uber. I want to see how widespread they are, he says. I want to know what the reception seems to be in the public. We'll have to see how they interact with the current system. Maybe we need to relieve some of our current taxes of bus systems. But it's all preliminary because he, too, is looking for information. And Howard and Jordan aren't alone. Hands of the law. The North Carolina House has 120 districts, but only 11 cities across the state have access to Uber. That means the media is the first impression of many North Carolina representatives, and the reports aren't necessarily good. Take the viral coverage of a New Delhi Uber driver charged with rape and kidnapping. The safety issue is one reason talk has been slow going in Raleigh. We don't want to have a knee-jerk reaction, explains Raleigh Councilwoman Marianne Baldwin. We want to be thoughtful. We want to look at what other communities are doing. It's a balance, she says, between safety considerations and progress, because it's not a question of whether to allow the services into Raleigh. They're already here, she says. It's about dealing with them in a proactive way. She compares the situation to what happened to food trucks. Years ago, Raleigh ordinances didn't permit them. We went through a very significant process to try to change our ordinances and come up with something that was fair to everybody, and I think we succeeded in doing that, she says. It took way too long, but we did succeed in coming up with something that allowed food trucks and protected existing businesses. With Uber and Airbnb, the technology has gotten ahead of our ordinances. Baldwin leads the committee considering the short-term rental topic. Under the current rules, only the owners of historic houses are allowed to rent rooms. But Raleigh is considering several options, such as creating a licensing and inspection process. Other municipalities have looked at the issue. Through a new rule that goes into effect in February, San Francisco Airbnb hosts will have to appear in person to register with town staff and prove that they live at the rental site. In some cities, San Francisco and Portland among them, Airbnb collects taxes on behalf of Airbnb hosts and guests automatically through its app. Uber is already technically banned in Portland, Oregon, the state of Nevada, Delhi, India, Thailand, Spain, China, France, Netherlands, and Taiwan. And on January 15, South Carolina ordered Uber to stop service in four cities. On the other hand, more than 22 jurisdictions in the U.S. have adopted permanent regulatory frameworks for rideshare, including places Raleigh competes with for economic opportunity, such as Dallas, Texas, and Nashville, Tennessee. In the end, none of that will matter if city, county, and state leaders are faced with a safety breach of these services in the Triangle. Overnight, the chatter will change, and so will the appetite to accommodate these shared services. In essence, the longer lawmakers wait to create the regulatory framework of shared services, the riskier it will get for the shared economy. And there are a number of graphs that go along with this article. The first one is two cars, one a taxi, one a regular car, making circles. And within the circles, there are some points. The first one is Hook Me Up Uber. Here's a list of the cities Uber works in North Carolina: Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, Charlotte, Winston-Salem, Greensboro, High Point, Burlington, Asheville, Wilmington, and Fayetteville. And in another point, did you know? To become an Uber driver, you must fill out an inquiry on the Uber website and submit to and pass a background check paid for by Uber with hirees. The check goes back 7 years and looks at driving records as well as local, multi-state, and federal courthouse records. And in another section, it lists what's here. Dog Vacay. The service connects pet owners with hosts who can watch your dog while on vacation. Move Loot, a service that just expanded to the Triangle that can help you sell and buy used furniture. And along with that, next to it, another list of what may be coming. Spin Lister allows you to rent bikes, surfboards, and snowboards from your neighbors. Leftover Swap allows you to share your leftovers with your neighbors. Eat With, an app that allows you to share a meal with a stranger. Task Rabbit service allows you to hire people for random tasks such as moving boxes. And then finally, in a They Said It section, first we have comment from Chris Heavely, co-founder of the Startup Factory. I think our ability to embrace the sharing economy is a signal to everyone who cares what kind of startup personality we wish to portray. Though each community has come out differently on how they will deal with these guys, we as an emerging startup economy need to be more aggressive than others. And another quote from Justin Miller, CEO of Raleigh-based WedPix. I'm tired of people saying that Raleigh is like the insert larger hip city here of this region. Instead, why don't we let Raleigh, North Carolina, be the place that finds the solution to this issue and let these other cities follow our lead? And we have one final graph that goes with this cover story. Taxi revenue supports local services. In Raleigh, taxi driver fees are budgeted into the general fund, where they support local government functions such as police, fire, emergency communications, and street maintenance. Raleigh's taxi driver revenues are as follows. 2010, $3,329. In 2009 to 2010, the Raleigh City Council approved changes to Raleigh's taxi ordinance, which increased the increased fee revenue and program requirements. 2011, $75,609. 2012, $85,890. 2013, $85,445. And 2014, $93,535. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. The first headline, he's ready to sell North Carolina to the world. Christopher Chung's first day as the new chief executive for the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina technically wasn't supposed to be until January 12, but the 38-year-old rising star in the economic development world arrived the week before. I decided to pack up and head east a little early, he says. I'm very excited about being part of this team in North Carolina. Chung, a native of Columbus, Ohio, and a diehard Buckeyes fan, is coming to North Carolina from Missouri, where he helped open the office of the Missouri Partnership 7 years ago, a public-private organization with similar goals as the EDPNC, helping the state attract new industry and jobs. Chung's new role in North Carolina, though, is also quite a step up from his previous duties in St. Louis, where he led an organization with an annual budget of about $2 million and a staff of 12. In contrast, the EDPNC opened in October with a budget of $17 million per year in state funding and about 40 people on staff and is growing. I really enjoyed my life in Missouri, and I'm proud to be part of that group from the ground up. And I probably never would have left if not for this opportunity in North Carolina, he says. This is only my second week in the state, and I can already see why it's such a magnet for people. Bar Rescue Chef revisits Garner Eatery. Back in March 2013, Spike TV's Bar Rescue and Chef Brian Duffy came to the Triangle to help a struggling Garner restaurant. That restaurant is now called Moon Runner's Saloon and has been a successful establishment ever since, thanks to Duffy. For the first time since 2013, Duffy was back at Moon Runner's on January 16 to help promote a limited-time Duffified menu. I was coming down to do an evaluation on the guy, so I thought, let's do something fun, Duffy says, hence the new menu. The chef admits that the five items on this new menu are things people normally wouldn't see at Moon Runner's, with items like the North Carolina poutine, which features pulled ribs, triple-cooked fries, cheddar curds, and a moonshine demi-glaze, and stuffed sliders packed with corned beef and sauerkraut. These dishes have the chef's twist written all over them. Other treats include the Duffified stuffed burger, triple cheese focaccia pizza, and the flat-stacked grilled cheese with blackened grilled shrimp. Philadelphia native Duffy studied at the restaurant school at Walnut Hill College and later worked with James Beard award-winning chef Jean-Marie LaCroix at the Four Seasons in Philly. Duffy has made numerous appearances on Food Network, DIY Network, GHTV, NBC, and the Fine Living Network. Raleigh Pear appears on Shark Tank, walks away from Cuban deal. A pair of Raleigh entrepreneurs, Becca Nelson and Ellie Brown, fought the ABC Sharks and could have walked away with $200,000 from investor Mark Cuban. Nelson and Brown, sisters who launched a novelty line of wearable fabric stickers, appeared on Shark Tank January 12 with their Raleigh-based company dubbed Everywhere's Sticky Ties. Everywhere's spelled E-V, capital R, capital E, W-A-R-E-S. And proceeded to get grilled. The pair asked the Sharks to invest $100,000 in return for 30% of their company, but the investors weren't biting, noting that $300,000 of the firm's sales happened in 2014 and that the pair are only on track to make around $50,000 this year. Cuban said instead of investing for partial equity, he'd just buy the whole business. "You have no idea what you're doing," he said on air. At the end of the show, they had a deal, but when the cameras clicked off, the sisters changed their minds and left Cuban in the dark. Mark and his team reached out right after the show, Brown says. It was really hard, but Becca and I didn't feel like we could sell our company. Rhino's nephew returns to Durham as Bulls' new manager. The Durham Bulls named Jared Sandberg, nephew of Hall of Famer Ryne Sandberg, as the club's new manager. The new manager replaces Charlie Montoyo, who was promoted to third base coach of the Tampa Bay Rays in mid-December. Sandberg spent the past seven seasons as a coach or manager at four different levels in the Rays minor league system. He had a 12-year playing career, including nine seasons in the Tampa Bay organization from 1996 to 2004. Parts of five of those seasons, 2000 to 2004, came as a member of the Durham Bulls. It was a big honor to promote Charlie to our major league staff, and it's an equally big honor to name Jared manager of the Durham Bulls, Rays director of minor league operations, Mitch Lukovic said. Jared's promotion is well deserved, and we know he shares our excitement in him joining the most storied franchise in minor league baseball. Sandberg is technically an employee of the Bulls' major league affiliate, the Tampa Bay Rays. Salary information was not released. Busan opens under leadership of sushi chef Toshio Sakamaki. Busan, a sushi restaurant in the Diamond View 3 building between the Durham Performing Arts Center and the Durham Bulls Athletic Park, opened on January 20. I'm trying to bring more of a traditional Japanese sushi making to Durham, says chef Toshio Sakamaki. I know that people are used to rolls and such, but I want to be more focused on the fishes and the sauces. Sakamaki was born in Tokyo and learned from his father, also a sushi chef. But he worked at Miura in Raleigh, M-U-R-A, before becoming head chef at Busan. Both are operated by the G. Patel-owned restaurant group, Echelon Experiences. And now we turn to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal. First, we have the page of Amanda Hoyle, who covers commercial and residential real estate. Her first headline, NAI Carol Lantick's Barns, now's a good time to sell income properties. Hot trends in the commercial real estate market over the past couple of years have focused a lot of attention on the Triangle's luxury apartment market, as well as the shift toward more open office space floor plan options. But NAI Carol Lantick Realty President Jimmy Barnes warns not to get too caught up in the hype. High-priced apartments. It's trendy now, but be assured many millennials will change their view and think the $2,000 to $3,000 they are spending on rent might be better spent on their own homes, especially considering interest rates. So the question is, can these renters be replaced? Barnes asked in an interview leading up to NAI Carol Lantick Realty's big commercial real estate conference event on January 21 at PNC Arena. Open office floor plans. Remember 5 to 7 years ago when economists and real estate experts said there will be a reduction in office space needs due to employees working out of their homes? Well, I didn't say that, and that didn't hold true. And now they are telling us that open floor plans are the way to go, creating collaboration and reducing office costs. But when companies start competing over workers, the bigger foosball table will not win out over the private office. Barnes also told the crowd of about 1,800 that absorption of office, industrial, and retail space was strong in the Triangle in 2014, with 4.7 million square feet absorbed and an office vacancy rate that dropped to 19% from 22% the year prior. He also noted that the Triangle region has 2.9 million square feet of new commercial real estate inventory under construction, marking the biggest construction year since 2004. However, Barnes is predicting that office demand will keep up with the new construction, with both the office and industrial markets maintaining healthy vacancies in 2015. His message to investors of income-producing properties? Now's a good time to sell and a good time to lock down interest rates. Kane moves forward on two major Raleigh projects. North Hills developer John Kane is moving forward on two major real estate projects in 2015 after announcing plans to build a new upscale hotel in Midtown Raleigh and going public with his ideas to build an ambitious tower project in downtown Raleigh's Warehouse District. Kane Realty Corporation is teaming up with Raleigh-based Concord Hospitality Enterprises to bring what will be the first AC Hotels by Marriott property in the Carolinas. The 133-room AC Hotel is expected to open in 2016 next to the new North Hills Tower. The new North Hills Tower 2 office building that is under construction at the corner of Six Forks and Dartmouth Roads. Kane Realty will also be breaking ground soon in a multi-story apartment project next to the hotel. In downtown Raleigh, Kane has filed a rezoning application for the 2.5-acre site that Dillon Supply, a 100-year-old Raleigh company, still uses for warehousing of its building supply products at the corner of West and Hargett Streets. The zoning designation that Kane has requested would allow for construction of a mixed-use building or buildings of between 13 and 20 stories high. And now we turn to the page of reporter Jason DeBruin, who covers healthcare and biopharmaceuticals. The first headline, How Rigado Fell So Far So Fast, Duke Spin Out to Be Acquired by San Francisco Company. For Rigado Biosciences, July 3, 2014, marked the beginning of the end. On that day, the company revealed safety concerns on a kit used in heart surgeries, a problem that would ultimately lead to a reverse merger and the company moving its headquarters to California. Since then, Rigado shares have plummeted, and the stock was in danger of being delisted from the NASDAQ exchange. The company laid off 60% of its workers, saw the CEO and chief medical officer resign, and finally, on January 14, reached an agreement with Tobera Therapeutics, known as a reverse merger, in which Tobera Therapeutics merges into a Rigado subsidiary, but is largely the remaining entity. Existing Rigado shareholders will own about one-third of the new company. Investors took a hit. In August 2013, Rigado, which has roots in a Duke University lab, completed an initial public offering and raised $41 million by selling shares at $4 apiece. In early 2014, it raised another $18.6 million in a private placement, and in April 2014, it raised $58 million by selling shares priced at $6 apiece. Just before the merger, shares had dropped to below $1. The troubles come down to a failed surgery kit Rigado had hoped to market for heart surgeries. The drug system being tested in a Phase 3 trial was called Revolixis Kit. It was being used in heart surgeries in which a physician mechanically opens or widens obstructed coronary arteries. The worldwide trial, dubbed REG-ULATE PCI, initially planned to enroll some 13,200 patients in 21 countries, but was halted due to safety concerns raised by the trial's Data and Safety Monitoring Board, DSMB, after an analysis of the first 3,250 patients. The DSMB indicated that the level of serious allergic adverse events associated with Revolixis was of a frequency and severity such that they recommended that we do not enroll any further patients in the REG-ULATE PCI trial, then CEO David Mazzo said in August. Looking ahead, Rigado shareholders will now follow Tobera. A reverse merger is a process by which a private company merges into a publicly traded company, largely to access public financing without going through the process of an initial public offering. In many ways, Rigado simply acts as a shell into which Tobera can fold itself. The new company will have corporate headquarters in San Francisco. Report: Salix hires Centerview Partners to pursue sale. For months, speculation about the fate of Raleigh's largest homegrown drug company, Salix Pharmaceuticals, has revolved around whether the company would be able to stay independent, especially since the multi-billion dollar drug company saw its longtime CEO, Carolyn Logan, step down earlier this month. Company chairman, Thomas DiAlonzo, has assumed the CEO role on an interim basis. Reuters reported that Salix had hired Centerview Partners, an investment bank, to assess the company's options, which may include an outright sale. With Logan's departure, it's clear that the board feels this is the right time to explore options since they don't have to deal with egos, personalities, strengths, and weaknesses of two CEOs just in case an M&A deal made sense. When the company is in transition for the top spot, this may be the right time to entertain deals. But Centerview may decide the best value for Salix shareholders is to remain independent, hire a new CEO, clear all the inventory issues, and continue to bolster its drug pipeline. Regardless, the news sent the company's stock upward nearly 5% on January 20 to close at $125.83 in an above-average trading volume day. And in a section called Funding, a strong week for pharma fundraising. In the Triangle, it's not uncommon for several organizations to raise big sums of money. Even so, this week seemed to be especially lucrative for local groups. Here are three quick hits. $50 million. Morrisville-based Clinipace Worldwide raised $50 million from investors, and the pharmaceutical research company plans to put that money to work through more acquisitions. It's a strategy Clinipace, and its CEO, Jeff Williams, have employed for the past few years to grow at an almost breakneck pace. The company has a three-year growth rate of 348% and has added more than 450 jobs since 2012. That said, Williams highlights organic growth as well. After all, Clinipace is now home to 700 global staffers, has managed 1,500 clinical research studies, activated 23,000 sites, enrolled 330,000 subjects, and managed 300 regulatory and strategic development engagements. $90 million? The Duke Clinical Research Institute could receive up to $90 million as one of three national sites chosen to run early clinical trials of new anti-infection therapies. The institute received a 10-year contract from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases to find treatments for diseases like influenza, methicillin-resistant staphylococcus, MRSA, and drug-resistant tuberculosis. The first clinical trials at Duke will likely start later this year after infrastructure is established, according to Dr. Michael Cohen-Wolkowitz, Director of Pharmacometrics and Assistant Director of the Duke Pediatric Clinical Research Unit at DCRI. And $37 million. Durham's Colucid Pharmaceuticals raised $37 million to continue development of a drug for migraines and headache pain. It's an important area of need. Some 36 million people suffer from migraines, or more than those who have asthma or diabetes combined. Migraine is ranked as the seventh highest cause of global disability and is one of the top 10 causes of disability in 14 of 21 world regions studied, according to findings by the Global Burden of Disease Survey 2010, conducted by the World Health Organization. It is the leading cause of disability among neurological disorders. The funding for Colucid comes partly from Pappas Ventures, a Durham-based life sciences investment group. And now we turn to the page for Lauren Onosorge, who covers technology and entrepreneurship. The first headline, RTP's Future, the Frontier. We stand in, and I am not kidding, what will be the largest open innovation center in America, Bob Giolis told the audience that filled the lobby. Giolis, the CEO of Research Triangle Park Managing Organization, the Research Triangle Foundation, addressed a crowd January 15 in a glass-paneled room at 800 Park Offices Drive. The crowd included many of the same people who, about a year ago, huddled together at the Research Triangle Park headquarters to hear about Giolis's vision for a new RTP. RTF had just announced its $17 million purchase of a 100-acre strip along I-40, and execs, Giolis leading the charge, were bullish about the urbanesque transformation of RTP. Someday, he says, this area will be revitalized with retail, restaurants, and hotels. But such a complete transformation will take time. We must move forward and we must do it now, he says. Geolis' team worked with developers to revamp the 90s-era building, a space that will be replaced someday. Today, it's already nearly half occupied, says Mason Aylstock, vice president of development. The building presented a different sort of challenge, he says. You have to work with what you have, he points out. You don't want to go spend a ton of money on making something that it isn't. The next step is finding more pioneers to have offices up here, he says. It's really about driving the community here, making this a destination, the Triangle's Main Street. The Frontier, a 142,000-square-foot building, will serve as a space to test ideas. Provost Studio provided branding design. Current tenants include the Army Research Office, A-10, Craze Brain, Science Trackout and Summer Camps, Entree Dot, Institute of Play, International Services Assistance Fund, National Inclusion Project, Triangle Artworks, and RTF's own White House-funded initiative, U.S. 2020 RTP. As for the physical development of the 100-acre site, RTF is collaborating with partners EENK, Perkins Eastman, Hines, Duda, Payne Hargreaves Associates, and Gensler. Infrastructure and design plans will soon be finalized, according to an RTF statement, although Geolis has said the site plan is complete. Raleigh, fertile ground for entrepreneurs. AOL co-founder Steve Case says, Raleigh is on the rise when it comes to entrepreneurship. It will just take time. I think the community has started to come together in a collaborative way to create more network density, which is a key part of this, he says. But funding issues remain, as it can still be hard to get investors on a plane from Silicon Valley. It's a case of glass is half full, not half empty, he says. There's reason to be optimistic, but also more reason to believe more work needs to be done to take Raleigh to the next level. Case says that, in general, people still don't get it. They don't really understand what's happening outside of California, New York, Massachusetts, he says. About 80% of the capital goes to those three states. When he tells people he just came back from Raleigh, they kind of look at me like, what? I thought everything was happening here. There's still naivete about what's happening. His advice? Keep telling Raleigh's story and celebrating its exits. It's only a matter of time before the investors get it. And in a section called Startup Corner, entrepreneurs in the Triangle expect growth in the next 6 months. That's according to a new survey conducted by the North Carolina State Entrepreneurship Clinic, which polled 168 local entrepreneurs. 91.1%. That's how many anticipate the next 6 months to bring an increase in sales. 59.9%. That's how many anticipate an increase in capital spending. And 61.7%, that's how many plan to increase employment. And in a section on this page called By the Numbers, about 9.5 million passengers traveled through Raleigh-Durham International Airport in 2014, up nearly 4% compared to the previous year. Delta led the carriers with 1,405,143 deplane passengers for 2014. But flights aren't the only number tracked by RDU's activity statistics. Here are some other numbers to round out the year at RDU. 316,357. That's how many taxicab trips were tracked at RDU. Compare that to 291,247 the year prior. 1,023,276. That's how many cars were tracked exiting the daily lots in 2014. 188. That's the average daily departure number, down one departure from 2013. And 91,600,000 869. That's how many pounds of luggage was loaded off of planes at RDU in 2014. And finally, in a section called He Said It, a quote from Greg Lowenhagen, founder of the Hopscotch Music Festival, speaks to TBJ shortly after confirming the takeover of the event by ETIX founder Travis Janovich. Lowenhagen will stay on as festival director. We don't expect much to change in 2015. Our goal collectively is always to figure out how to keep the festival fun and artist-friendly while achieving sustainability as a business. And now we turn to the A Better World page written by Todd Cohen. And first we have the column written by Todd Cohen, who also publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. The headline, Furniture for Households in Need. In 2010, when she began staging homes to be sold by her friend, Beth Smoot, a broker associate at Fonville Morrissey, Jackie Craig found many people selling homes were reluctant to part with furniture and other household items, and if they were willing to let go, often did not know what to do with those belongings. As a longtime volunteer for JobStart, a partnership of the Presbyterian Church and State Division of Prisons that supports women getting out of prison, Craig also understood a big challenge those women faced was finding furnishings to start a new home. The solution was the Green Chair Project, an effort she and Smoot founded to collect donated furniture and distribute it to people recovering from crisis. With an annual budget of nearly $500,000, 3 full-time and 3 part-time employees, and more than 1,000 volunteers, the Raleigh nonprofit has provided 25,000 items of furniture or household goods for 1,000 households, or nearly 3,000 individuals, roughly 80% of them women and children. We're giving people a meaningful way to put their old items to good use here in our community and keeping them out of the landfill, says Craig, who serves as executive director. Each week, through appointments coordinated by 55 partner agencies focusing on issues ranging from homelessness, domestic violence and incarceration, to mental health and disaster relief, individuals from 4 to 8 households visit Green Chair at the 27,000 square foot building on Capitol Boulevard it leases from Alfred Williams and Company. The partner agencies pay a $25 referral fee, and households contribute $50 to $250 depending on how much furniture and other items they need and can afford. Each household gets one visit only to furnish its home. In return, an individual or family gets points to spend, with the point system representing a fair way to ration the furniture and provide the dignity of choice, Craig says. Donors can drop off furniture and other items at the Green Chair Project, which also partners with 4 moving companies that will pick up donated furniture for a discounted fee, and with one company that will deliver it at no cost to households that participate. Volunteers, ranging from high school students to senior citizens, sort and wash donated items. Through a partnership with the Wake County Public School System and 2 bedding stores, the Green Chair Project has provided mattresses for about 100 children who have no beds and aims to provide 200 mattresses in 2015. The nonprofit generates income through contributions and grants from individuals, foundations, and the City of Raleigh, and an annual gala, as well as 4 retail sales each year to the public that account for up to 1/3 of its annual budget. While the Green Chair Project has grown significantly in just 5 years, Craig says its plan now is to focus on strengthening its programs with partners to better serve Wake County and put more families in beds and homes. And in nonprofit news, V Foundation seeks marathon team. The V Foundation for Cancer Research is again joining as a charity partner with the Rock and Roll Raleigh Marathon. Team V hopes to build on the success from last year when it helped raise more than $300,000 for the foundation. Members who meet the $750 fundraising minimum will receive free entry into either the half or full race, training and race day gear, access to an exclusive pre- and post-race hospitality tent, as well as personalized fundraising support. Members who raise $1,500 or more will additionally receive a premium race day apparel item and VIP swag bag. Woolly Bulls Anti-Bullying Road Trip. The Durham Bulls will bring back the anti-bullying program, Bully Busters, which debuted in February 2014. The initiative, in which the Bulls provide free school assemblies to raise awareness for a priority issue in elementary schools, will travel to schools throughout Durham County and expand this year to include Wake and Orange counties as well. Using popular mascot Woolly Bull as the driving force, each interactive assembly engages students in recognizing bullying behavior and exploring what to do should they witness or experience bullying. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal, where first we'll read a guest column written by Mike Walden, who is an economist at NC State University. The headline, North Carolina's Road Building Strategy Needs a Refill. My wife recently bought a new car. Well, not exactly new car, but newly used. With a new to her car, she is now super cautious about driving it. She's particularly sensitive to potholes and cracks in the road. And now that she's noticing them, she's complaining there are too many. Dissatisfaction with roads, traffic, and congestion is common. When we drive, we'd like to have a smooth road all to ourselves. Of course, most of us know this isn't possible. Still, it's natural to get upset sitting in stopped traffic or hitting one of those potholes. The latest statistics show some challenges for North Carolina's transportation infrastructure. More than 60% of the urban interstate roads in the state are considered to be congested, and 30% of the state's bridges are reported to be deficient. Both of these rates are higher than the national averages. Part of the reason is that North Carolina is a growing state. Also, the most rapid population growth is in the already highly populated metropolitan areas of the state. When more people are packed into the same space, roads get more congested and suffer more wear and tear. There are private costs to an overly strained infrastructure system. In a traffic jam, we're using time that could better be spent some other way. We're also burning gasoline. And of course, if we later hit a pothole, who knows what damage will be done. Studies suggest all this costs the average car-owning household $1,700 a year in wasted time and money. A lack of sufficient infrastructure can also cost a region income in another way. The movement of people to work and the movement of many inputs and final products, and even services, require the use of roads and bridges. Indeed, when a business is considering moving to an area, local infrastructure is a major factor on its checklist. So insufficient infrastructure can lead to a lack of jobs and income-earning opportunities. For almost eight decades, roads and bridges have been built and financed mainly as government projects. In North Carolina, the state government takes the lead. The typical process for the state to build or upgrade a road or bridge has been to borrow money from investors and repay the debt with funds collected from gas taxes and other vehicle-related fees. The road or bridge built today is paid for by current and future drivers. But this model has fallen apart with increasing resistance to gas taxes. Over time, gas tax rates, which are applied to gallons bought, have to rise to keep pace with inflation. But understandably, drivers became sensitive to gas tax rates, especially when the price of gasoline was constantly rising. Plus, fuel efficiency has been increasing, meaning drivers can get more road mileage from each gallon of gas, so the gas tax has not been getting the job done. This is why the North Carolina Department of Transportation's new road plan talks about public-private partnerships to help meet the state's future infrastructure needs. Such partnerships have been used in other states, and there have been some cases here in North Carolina. The typical plan is for the state to pay for a portion of an infrastructure project in the normal way, using bonds and then gas taxes or other fees to service the debt. The other part of the cost, often a majority, is then financed by a private company. The company may also issue bonds, and those bonds are repaid by earnings the company receives from the project. In the case of a road, these earnings are usually in the form of tolls. Many experts think these public-private partnerships are the financing method of the future for infrastructure. They can be applied to roads, bridges, and even ports. Still, toll roads are despised by many drivers. But the question is, can infrastructure be built the old-fashioned way? And if new infrastructure isn't built, do we all pay in some other way? You can decide if the old saying, pay me now or pay me later, should apply. And also on the Viewpoint page, there's the editor's notebook. This is written by Sugata Mukherjee, the editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Wealth Redistribution Talk Fills Up Davos Air. Every year, Oxfam, the community-based international group of 17 organizations that work in 94 countries, releases what many call the Global Income Inequality Study. The group releases the findings right before the world's business leaders converge on Davos, Switzerland, for the World Economic Forum. This year, the Oxfam study noted that the richest 1% in the world will have more wealth than the remaining 99% combined by next year. Really an incredible assertion any way you look at it. And for a couple of days in Davos, almost everyone was talking about the findings, at least according to media reports. Oxfam's conclusion is based on global data, not just U.S., although the report noted that 35 of the world's 80 richest billionaires are in the U.S. The income inequality issue played a pivotal role in President Barack Obama's State of the Union speech on January 20, followed by a few worldwide organizations asking countries to change, replace, and implement new laws to protect the middle class. All this sounds good in theory, but this snapshot in time is missing one primary element. Global wealth is about to come under its own redistribution. Let me explain. On January 21, PricewaterhouseCoopers released its annual CEO survey that noted that more than twice as many CEOs are now convinced of a poor global economy compared to last year. Still, 37% of the CEOs believe economic conditions will improve, the report states. With the U.S. economy improving and Asia and Europe slowing, there is going to be a mad dash among foreign manufacturers and service providers to seek out U.S. consumers because that's the market it is growing. PwC's study reflects that as well. Wait, what? We thought everyone wanted to go to China. The International Monetary Fund forecasts China's GDP growth in 2015 will be about 6.3%, down from the 10% plus the country had for years. Furthermore, Japan is struggling and Russia is a financial mess. So remember the BRIC, B-R-I-C countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China. Looks like some of these BRIC countries may be shooting bricks for some time. Inevitably, if this seismic economic shift from China to the U.S. is sustainable, the U.S. is going to get richer. And in light of the Oxfam report, perhaps the better question for our country, its billionaires and its lawmakers should be, how do we make sure that all the hardworking Americans participate in this next wave of wealth creation, just not the top 1%? And now we'll turn to the People on the Move page in the Triangle Business Journal. And the spotlight is on Lee Hogwood, Raleigh Administrative Partner at K&L Gates. Attorney Lee Hogwood began his now more than 25-year legal career at Kennedy, Covington, Lobdell, and Hickman. That firm joined forces with global firm K&L Gates in 2008. Fast forward to 2015, Hogwood has now stepped into the role of administrative partner in the firm's Raleigh office. In his current post, Hogwood is charged with what he calls helping clients connect with the right lawyer with the right capabilities in the right office to solve client problems and ultimately to help our team achieve greater success. K&L Gates employs 52 attorneys in its Raleigh and Mooresville offices combined, making it one of the 10 largest law firms in the Triangle. Mary Beth Johnston serves as the administrative partner in Mooresville. What is one thing you wish people knew about your job? We are a working partnership, which means I keep my day job of lawyering for my clients while also trying to facilitate client service and good results for my colleagues. Client demands drive our business, and so it is very clear to me that I'm not anyone's boss. Our bosses are the clients who live outside the walls of our office. Our success is driven by their calls, emails, and visits, and our responsiveness to them. What are some of your major goals in this position? Our office has attracted work from many companies in this state and nearby states. I would hope to see those expanding work trends continue and, in the face of that increasing and diversified client demand, would hope to continue to attract additional talented lawyers so we can grow the office to serve that increasing demand. Biggest pet peeve? You might get a straight answer to this question if you ask my children. If pressed, the answer has to be this: a person who appears to lack enthusiasm. Biggest worry? I worry that in the rush of the day, the deal, the case, we often forget to teach new lawyers that you have to love what you do or you cannot do it well. Clients will suffer in the end if we don't pass on that passion to the next generation. Triangle business person you most admire? I admire Jimmy Talton of Cap Trust. Personal: wife, Anne. Children, Hannah, Sarah, and Benjamin. Last book read: The Bully Pulpit by Doris Kearns Goodwin. And finally, we have the results of the Business Survey Pulse. The question: do you think the city of Raleigh and the state of North Carolina worked out a fair deal on the Dorothea Dix campus sale? 69% of respondents say yes. 31% say no. The number of responses in total was 381. And we're going to stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.